Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. No, not just an ordinary episode, because as I was reminded today by my co-host, Barbeau Rose, I'm sorry, Barry Rose, I can't get that picture out of my my thought process, Barry. Today is 2 years. 2 years of uninterrupted fucking Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. Barry, how are you and those massive jugs doing?
Yeah, I tell you what, Aaron Grafton has single-handedly ruined masturbation for the 1,500 Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry group members in the Facebook group, because even I looked at it and I said, oh my God, that's absolutely horrific. So what did you
do? You had to put the hand cream down after you saw that picture.
Oh, I think it's going to haunt some people the rest of their lives, actually. So yeah,
it was not a pretty thing to see. You did not make a good looking woman. That's all I'm going to say.
Understatement.
Although there were a few people that said they would hit it, you know, so, you know, yeah. Kudos to you, Bear. You still got it, baby.
No, kudos to them for lowering their standards to the point that they would hit something that looked remotely like me in any form. But Jeff, you said the all important words at the beginning of the episode. This is our 2 year anniversary, and it's hard to believe.
Two, just like Bill Watts on a Mid-South episode where the crowd is chanting two.
Then we should bring on the sweetest man in all of California, sweet Lou Kippelman, our producer extraordinaire, really the third member, the Spinderella, if you will, of Salt and Pepper.
Really?
We do. That's absolutely. He's our Jam Master Jay, our Spinderella. He is.
That is the first time I believe the term Jam Master Jay or Spinderella has been used on this program.
Yes.
I've been drinking before this episode, absolutely. So
some Four Loko, I guess, yeah.
Lou is no Lisa Left Eye Lopez, I don't mind telling you that.
Why, thank you.
No burning down this house.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, Andre Terra Ryzen, yes. Yeah, here I am. As always, privileged and proud to be behind the wheels of steel on the mighty Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry machine.
A t-shirt, Barry. There's a t-shirt behind the wheels of steel. So anyway, on this this episode, folks, we're not just going to talk about Spinderella and the third wheels. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, wrestling, life. And today it's time for part two of our Hall of Fame discussion. The pages of Breaking Kayfabe getting a little heated with some people's thoughts. So we're going to be talking about that, revisiting a couple candidates that were discussed. Besides all that, we're going to be looking at a match, and Barry, I think you will have to agree with me, as recommended by Brandon New, we have one kick-ass match of the week to discuss this week. It's Fit Finley versus Steven Regal from March 24th, 1996, WCW Uncensored, Tupelo, Mississippi. They went to the hometown of the King, Elvis Presley, for this one.
Yeah, this is, I mean, we don't need to get into the review right now, but Brandon New, Patrick, to give yourself a Barry Horowitz pat on the back, because this was stellar. Yeah, absolutely stellar.
I started watching this and I was like, fuck me, Brandon. I don't remember if I watched this when it happened live, because I really wasn't a huge WCW fan at that point, but this was a solid recommendation. And maybe he stepped over Aaron Grafton on the recommendation thumbs up chart there. So you got that going for you. So before we get into the wrestling discussion, Barry, of course, we like to talk occasionally about the food topics here. And first things first, noticed, and I sent you the link. Here, South Florida's very own Sun Sentinel taking a topic discussed on Breaking Kayfabe, making it the headline story of the front page, Barry. Tell the good folks about that.
Yeah, actually, Jeff, I don't have that in front of me, so I'm going to let you tell all
well,
the
that's,
good folks
that's
about
the kind
that.
Of preparation you get here on Breaking Kayfabe. It's the discussion we had last week about the tipping, you know, and then the extra surcharge for those large parties made the front page of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. So, you know, apparently those folks are listening to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. What do you think, Bear?
Yeah, definitely too. And we talked to, you know, and I like that too. I like that we can discuss, we obviously break kayfabe on everything, but that we can discuss a lot of the restaurant stuff and food related stuff. And the whole tipping thing too is absolutely crazy. And I read an article, it's coincidentally, you're saying that I read an article this morning, and it was how restaurants in New York are suffering with this $15 tipped minimum wage that's currently taking place there. So, you know, there's good and there's bad in a lot of different ways. But that was interesting that you brought that up last week. You texted me, you sent me the link, and then you texted me over this weekend and you go, holy shit, look what made the front page of the Sun Sentinel, which is really the Fort Lauderdale newspaper, probably the most popular newspaper in all of South Florida right now, surpassing the old stodgy Miami Herald, Jeff.
Yeah, that's true. So speaking of food, wanted to tell you, Barry, and I saved this one for the show, Mrs. Bowdrin with a recent food experience that I thought you might find interesting. So, of course, Mrs. Bowdrin starting the new job. She's now on her second week at the new therapy position that she obtained. And so she walks across the street the other day, and I'm going to give the place a little love. It's called, it's a great name for a Mexican place, called 10 Lizzie's, you know, so shout out to our boy Phil Linnett. So anyway, so Kim goes to the Mexican place for a little lunch. She's got about a half hour. So she goes in there, just orders the proverbial bowl of soup or cup of soup. The restaurant a little delayed in getting it out to her. So my wife says to the owner, she goes, hey, listen, can I just take my soup to go? Because my lunch is pretty much ending here. And the place is just right across the street from where she's working. And the owner came over and said, oh, my God, I'll rush it out to you right now. Brings the thing over to my wife, tells my wife that she doesn't have to pay for the soup because the guy felt like they didn't get it to her on time. And my wife says, well, you need to tell me how much it costs because, you know, I need to know how much to tip the server. The guy says, I tell you what, rather than tip the server, come back and see us again and give us another chance. I think that's a pretty good way of doing business, Barry. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, too. So one of the first things I was taught when I got into the restaurant business and I got into the management side was it wasn't about the fuck up, because every restaurant's going to make a mistake and going to screw up. But it's really about the recovery, and it's what you can do to recover from a bad situation to ensure that the guest and the diner is going to come back to your restaurant. So I fully agree. A couple of weeks ago, my wife was out of town, and Zoe being my daughter. We went out to dinner. I think it was like four nights in a row, maybe even five nights in a row. And we went to a restaurant and my entree showed up and hers did not. And the manager came over and basically said, I apologize. I'm real sorry. I've gone back in the kitchen. When your entree does arrive, I will come over. I'll make sure that everything is good. And your dinner is on me tonight. So that's really the way to do it. You know, my daughter was saying, what do you think they're going to do? And that's what you're supposed to do. You know, make people that are spending money feel comfortable in your establishment. So good. And congratulations to Mrs. Bowdrin, too, working for a fantastic facility in the Atlanta, Georgia region. Probably the best, right? The best in the entire state. You got to be proud, Jeff.
If she's working there, it's the best facility in the entire state. I can tell you that.
Nice.
So, all right. Now, also want to mention to the folks that are out there that have not yet subscribed to our YouTube channel. I have one question for you. What the fuck is the matter with you people? What are you waiting for? We give you two fucking years of solid content here. We got the stuff up on the YouTube page. You got your thumb up your ass. What are you waiting for? Okay, that's my rant, Barry. We're done with that. Please avail yourself of the opportunity. Go to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry on the old YouTube and hit the subscribe button to help me and help a brother out. You know, I'm sitting here and Mrs. Bowdrin's working, supporting the whole family. I got things to do. You know, Barry, you know what I've been doing with my time? I didn't take
a lot of masturbation, Jeff.
Well, no, not after porn. I saw that picture. That's pretty much stopped dead.
Yeah, you're done. Yeah.
Yeah. So watching taking a chance to watch the Antenna TV and MeTV, have you ever had a chance to watch these two fine channels?
Yeah. So I've seen both. We've been getting a both here for years. I think Antenna TV as well, but MeTV, they just started running the Flintstones at 6 o'clock at night, right? Am I correct?
Yeah. I have availed myself to watch old episodes of Johnny Carson, which is always great. And this, of course, not available on the ATTUverse. I've watched the old episodes of Hogan's Heroes. But here's what's really interesting. I started, just for shits and giggles, to sit there and start recording at night old episodes of Mannix and Cannon. Do you remember these two fine detective shows?
Oh, Cannon with William Conrad.
And what a great actor he is, by the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told my wife, it's really funny. There was an episode I watched. And by the way, the thing I love about both these shows is any episode you watch, there are so many great character actors that are on these shows that time has just forgotten. And I'm like going, oh, my God. I was watching one today, and I think Whit Bissell, who was on I Dream of Jeannie and a bunch of other, like, I think he did a couple Twilight Zones. Just a great character actor
he
was
did?
On his. Yeah. And but, you know, William Cannon, of course, the gimmick was he's a large detective, shall I say. OK. And he was chasing after this guy. They always put the fat guy in the situations where he's in a foot chase. OK, so he's chasing a guy through a used car lot or a car dealership lot. And the guy runs between two cars that are parked very close together. Cannon's following him. And they actually have on the screen where Cannon can't fit between the two cars and has to go around the cars. And I'm like, "One, really? Did they feel the need to do that to William Conrad? Because people hadn't figured out that he was an overweight gentleman. They had to have him get stuck between the two fucking cars. Shame on the producers and director of that episode for putting that kind of stuff on William Conrad, a fine, fine character actor, Barry.
Yeah, that's a little rough to be doing something like that, too. And he was. Jeff, what was the show that he did in the 80s? He did also a Jake and the Fat Man. Remember that?
Yes. I do recall that show. And you mentioned it. Yeah. Again, poking fun at poor William Conrad.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's funny because I can remember, and of course, naturally, the movie doesn't come. He had a career, much like Raymond Burr did before he was Perry Mason. Raymond Burr always played, no pun intended, the heavy, the bad guy as a character actor in movies. And William Conrad was a bad guy in a lot of character roles in the movies, like in the 50s and early 60s. So before he became, you know, of course, Cannon was his breakout role. So now let's get to our match of the week as recommended, as we said, by Brandon New. We are going to, again, I say March 24th, 1996, Tupelo, Mississippi, WCW Uncensored. WCW right now is smoking hot at the time of this match. And we get Steven Regal versus Fit Finlay. Barry, tell the good folks what you thought of this match.
Well, this is this after one viewing, and I must have seen. I'm trying to think where the fuck. No, I wouldn't have seen this match in 96. I was all over the board in 96. So I don't think I would have seen this match. This was probably as good as it gets. And this is my style of wrestling. It's that British, the Wigan style, the Snake Pit, Billy Riley style of wrestling. These are two guys who know how to shoot. They know how to hook, and they're stiff as fuck. And this match is this quickly is going to get another viewing on a big screen, because I was watching it today on my iPad, Jeff, just before we were actually getting ready to record. And I was just blown away. And then I started researching the match otherwise afterwards. But so this match starts off. Dusty is on commentary with Bobby the Brain Heenan. Dusty calling William Reeves, and I'm going to call him William, even though he's Steven Regal here. Steven Regal, he calls his servant, his butler, whose name was Jeeves. He calls him Chives. I don't know what to, for life of me, I had to rewind it, and I backed up, and I'm going, did he just call him Jives instead of Jeeves? and then Bobby Heenan goes, what did you just call him? And apparently he called him Chives. I don't know. Finley's mullet, Jeff, you've got to feel a little responsible for Finley's mullet.
That is an epic, epic mullet. There's no question about that.
Yeah. I think if you're looking in the dictionary or the encyclopedia for a mullet, this is the photo that's going to show up. And Jeff, this rivals yours.
Well, now, wait a minute.
It does. It's right there. It's that is as epic a mullet as you'll ever get. This match starts.
That mullet, by the way, if you're looking for an example of what my mullet looked like, available at crowbarpress.com, my book.
Hold on.
Just throwing a little plug out there.
Wow, that was wonderful. That was five stars.
I am the master of the segue, sir.
Oh, you.
They call me Booker.
You own that shit, Jeff. Absolutely. That was spectacular. But I don't know if I can recover from that. That was so good. But yes, it was. The match starts off. It is Finley, the Belfast brawler. Do they even refer to him as Finley in this match, or is it strictly?
You know, that is actually something that I noted was that when the match goes on, they're calling him the Belfast Bruiser.
Yeah.
For most of the first part, but I think at some point during the match they refer to him as Fit Finley. So you know, I don't know if that's some sort of nickname that he had at the time in the program or what, but yeah, definitely a good point. I made a note of that myself.
Yeah, it was but he was he's a house of fire right out of the gate. Starts off with these really high impact punches, kicks, clotheslines, and you can hear flesh on flesh, that loud slapping noise that's being made with these clotheslines and these kicks. This is no guys slapping their knee or slapping a back. This is them actually laying into people. It was just brutal, very, very stiff. Finley's got the early offense. He's working over Regal's arm. And Regal's taking a shitload of abuse here. And his offense is great, but a lot of this match, the story really seems to be Finley just being this bruiser type of wrestler that's just beating the shit out of Regal. Regal does do one thing. He does what I call the old Ernie Ladd move. And Ernie Ladd was the first guy that I ever see ever do this. This was going back some 40-something years ago. But Ernie Ladd would actually put his shin over a guy's throat, and then he would cover the guy and then argue with the referee. And Regal does that here, and I've always loved that move. Regal's nose. You ever see that video or that photo from years ago where the male model Fabio was
hit by the bird?
Yeah, and then you look at him, and it's like somebody had just fucking splattered his nose onto his face, and he's covered in blood. That's kind of what this actually looks like, because Regal's nose is busted open. There's blood everywhere. He's just a bloody mess. And I really, this match, if I was going to rate it on a star scale, and I realize that's a very polarizing comment that a lot of people hate the whole star rating system, but this is arguably as good as you're going to get for an American match. There's not a lot of high flying or anything like that, but from being really stiff and some really inventive tie-ups and hook holds and shooting holds and things like that, this is fantastic. The only thing I didn't like was, of course, it being WCW, they had to go to a non-finish, and the Blue Bloods came out, the Blue Bloods being David Taylor and the great British wrestler Bobby Eaton.
Lord Robert Eaton, I believe.
Lord Robert Eaton, which that makes no sense. But they were actually a decent tag team, though. But they came out. They attacked the Belfast.
Lou is right. Earl Robert of Eaton.
Earl Robert of Eaton.
And Lou with a solid intel. Here, let me remind the folks again, Barry, on our second anniversary. Thank you very much. Continue, Barry.
And Lou always with the very solid intel. And just so people know, too, that when Jeff and I just sit here and we do X amount of preparation, some weeks a little more than others. But if there's something that we miss, Lou is frantically always texting us to either give us the answer or give us the correct answer if we put out some false information. So, again, we call him producer extraordinaire. We're not just saying that, not just blowing smoke up his beautiful ass. We actually mean it. Sweet Lou is our Spinderella, Jeff, no matter what anyone says. But this was a great match, and I hated the finish. And again, it was a WCW finish. But I didn't have enough time to look at this, and I'm sure Lou will come forth with the answer. But had these two ever wrestled previously over in the UK? And if so, how the fuck can I see that?
Yeah, this is good stuff. I mean, there's no question about it. I do agree with you. I did not like the finish. I don't know why they just couldn't go to a draw, for God's sakes, you know, at that point, because they were literally, I think, 30 minutes away or 30 seconds away from the end of the match happening. So here's some notes that I took on the match. We also had Tony Schiavone on the call of the match. I have to say, if you want to talk five stars on anything, let's talk about whether it's William or Steven Regal, his facials, Barry, during this match are so good. I mean, man, this is a guy that has spent years in the industry crafting just the expressions and the stories that are told on his face when he's hit or when he's, you know, he's applying a move and he's selling it to the audience. It's just absolutely amazing. Let's see, Bobby Heenan with a couple of really good lines. He was talking back and forth with the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. He says, "I don't speak Texas," which I thought was a really funny line. And he pointed out as this match was going on that this was a competition between a guy from Ireland and a guy from England. He said, literally, this is Ireland versus England, just to throw a little extra spin into the match, which I think was really good stuff. Regal's palm strikes to Fit Finlay's head. This was almost like watching a damn MMA fight. I mean, this was almost like it was booked to be a work shoot. That's how hard these guys were hitting each other, for God's sake. A very 70s style, very strong style-esque, I said, you know, or I wrote down the clotheslines, stiff as hell. I also made note of the mullet. I don't want you to get full credit for that, Barry, because I also made a notation on that. Tony Schiavone pointing out that Fit Finlay's strategy is to hurt people, which I thought was a pretty good line from Tony. I noted on the website whatculture.com, this was voted the number 8 stiffest match of all time. So yeah, you know, get that going for it.
So Jeff, just to touch base. So I actually pulled up that article, and that was from What Culture, if I'm correct. No, I think you may have said I wasn't. You may have said, well, yeah, but
you
weren't
listening. Is that what you were going to say?
Well, I was actually reading the article. But did you read the last paragraph of that article? And I will find it right here. And it basically, WCW had a no blading policy at the time. But according to both men, officials approached Finlay and Regal beforehand and told them it would be great. And the word great is in quotation marks. If they could have some blood in the match. To deliver, Finlay hit Regal so hard he broke his nose, causing recurring problems that would eventually cause him to need surgery in 2002.
Wow. Yeah, that's a stiff shot, needless to say. And then Finlay also at the 1630 mark hits Regal with a shot right to his eye. And I don't know whether, you know, I thought at first when I first saw it, I said, oh, my God, he's opened him up there with a hard way. And that's right after. So, you know, maybe I don't know when he went down or maybe the shot didn't. I thought it hit the top of his like right on his brow. But maybe that was the shot from the nose that opened him up because it was, oh, my God, just absolutely brutal like this. And Bobby Heenan correctly pointing out that these guys are going to feel the, you know, what this match and all the stuff that's going on in it, they're going to feel this match 2 months down the road. So I also, you know, like Barry, as I watched this, I was like, holy shit, this is the proverbial 5-star match because it's so compelling. It draws you in so much. And by the way, can I point out, this is a match that does all those things with two guys who were not main eventers in WCW. Okay, this match completely hooked me, drew me in, and then they had that dumbass finish where the Blue Bloods run in. And to me, it really, you know, it's like you got the, you know, the hand cream in your hand and then you see the picture of Barry Rose in drag. You know, that's what happens at the end of this match. So I'm going to give this match 5 stars, but I'm taking away a solid 0.5 star for that fucked up finish. And I don't know who booked that, but those, oh my God, why couldn't they just go to a fucking draw on this, Barry?
Or just why would it be so hard for one of the guys to go over and they set up and they have a return match or something? Just for the life of me, but to have that finish, just a cheap finish, and it kills the match because you're arguably having, and I don't know what the rest of the matches on the pay-per-view were, but you're having one of the better matches that I, you know, in WCW at the time. Again, you had guys like Hulk Hogan, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall can actually work, but you know, you had some guys on top that were just terrible that couldn't have good matches. And then
are you trying to say, just to clarify, Barry, for one of our listeners in the great state of Illinois, are you trying to say that Kevin Nash could not work?
Yeah,
I want to clarify that for that one particular listener.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin Nash, to me, he's a blight on professional wrestling and has been for years. But highly intelligent, Jeff, because a guy with super limited skills really became a multi-millionaire through his political maneuverings in professional wrestling. So as much as I don't like him, I have to give him credit for being highly intelligent because he made a career. You know, if he was 6 inches shorter, would he have made a dime in this business?
He would have been Van Hammer.
Well, I don't even think he would have been Van Hammer. I don't think.
But I guess the way that you could put it is, for a guy that was not a great worker, he was a great worker because
there you go.
He's worked himself into a lot of damn money. Now, enough about that guy who's not a great worker and who should never be considered for the Hall of Fame. Let's go back to our Hall of Fame discussion, part two. There's another great segue. I'm Barry. That is me. Once again, the king of segues. So it's time. Let's look back to last week's show and discuss the guys that we all agreed on. We had the Mongolian Stomper, the Von Bronners with Saul Weingroff, Blackjack Mulligan, Rocky Johnson, and Sergeant Slaughter. Now then, Barry, there was a young gentleman who, well, let's just say that he disagreed with some of our thoughts. His name was Chris Chenault. And why don't we tell the folks about what Chris had to say about some of our fine, you know, people that were up for the ballot. I believe he took issue with Rocky Johnson, Dick Slater, and who was the other one that he had? Was it Murdoch?
Yeah, I don't know if it was even Rocky. I think it was Wahoo and the two Dicks. Travis Raines, that was for you. It was the two Dicks of Slater and Murdoch. And and we should also throw Rick Martel in there, because there were a lot of people that felt that you and I, and why don't we discuss Martel first, that you and I were too dismissive of Rick Martel, a guy that was a very solid wrestler, which he was, a guy that was AWA champion for a year and a half. And people felt that you and I did not give him the proper recognition that he deserved. So, Jeff, I'll tell you what I think when it comes to Martel, and then you certainly can chime in. And a lot of this will probably be stuff that we said last week. We'll be reiterating some of the same comments. But so Rick Martel, first off, if getting in the Hall of Fame is predicated by the fact that he was the AWA champion for a year and a half, that makes no sense to me, because the AWA was a very small regional territory. You can call it a world's heavyweight champion if you want, but at the end of the day, how many states did the AWA cover? And I don't want to piss off, you know, AWA hardcores, etc. There was some excellent wrestling that came out of there, but at the same time, that was a regional territory, despite the world heavyweight title being a part of it. But what did it cover? Four states, maybe five? Did they venture into fucking North Dakota once a year? Does that count? But essentially, it was a couple of states. It wasn't this big, you know, it wasn't the NWA. And that's always, to me, that is going to be the standard bearer, the NWA, because it, you know, or the WWF. And the reason I would say that is based off the exposure. The AWA, especially in the mid-80s, was not a powerhouse. In the early 80s, it certainly was. But, you know, after a certain point, it just wasn't. And you know, granted, Stan Hansen came in, and Stan Hansen was the world champion. Stan Hansen should be in every fucking Hall of Fame, but not based off of being the AWA World's Heavyweight Champion. So I don't see where Rick Martel holding that title for a year and a half predicates the fact that he should be in the Hall of Fame. Excellent worker, so I'm not going to take a thing away from him. Supposedly one of the nicer guys in professional wrestling, and even his last matches, which we talked about in WCW last week, Jeff, they were fantastic. He was a fantastic wrestler. It really depends on what your criteria for a Hall of Fame is, if you're going to put a guy like Martel in. To me, and again, this is not to take away, he was in tag teams for the majority of his career, at least on the national stage. But really, how many territories did Rick Martel work where he was on top? And I'm talking major territories. Is Portland a major territory? You tell me, Jeff. I don't know. Is it?
No, I don't think we could give it that.
Is being one half of a tag team, which was really where a lot of people knew him from, whether it was Strike Force or whatever the other one he was. Was it in two tag teams?
He was a Tony Garea.
Tony Garea, right.
And he also had the one with Tommy Rich in the late 70s, I want to say.
Where was that? Was that
in Georgia? In Georgia.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think he had main event runs in enough territories to qualify going in as a single in the Hall of Fame. But granted, to that point, and the whole Hall of Fame thing is really bogus when you stop and think about it, there are less qualified guys already in there. So I get that. Now, getting to Slater, Murdoch, and Wahoo. I don't know where to start on this one. There were some comments that I saw, and I don't want to call anybody out specifically, but there were some comments in there that Murdoch and Slade, well, you know, fuck it. Ron Stevenson was the one that really got me hopped up, so I am going to call him out. But there were some comments that were made that these guys never main evented on top anywhere. So I got to take a deep breath because I don't want to go on a full fucking rant right now, Jeff, but that really bothers me. And what bothers
me. Okay. Let's take it one at a time. Ron says these guys did not main event any other territories or were not headliners at any other territories. So let's take Rocky Johnson. Did Rocky Johnson ever headline a territory? Barry, take it.
Did Rocky Johnson ever work a territory and not actually headline the territory? That's the better question that I think you would want to ask right there, too. The only one I could say would be the WWF or whatever it was called at the time, because he was put into a tag team with Tony Atlas, but did hold the tag team title. Every territory that Rocky Johnson worked across the United States, he was in the main event. He held titles in those territories. He did that for 20 years. He drew money. Ron Stevenson said something that literally I had to be restrained. And I'm going to tell you, somebody messaged me and said, don't argue with him because you're going to make yourself nuts if you do. Ron Stevenson said, I've never met or talked with anybody that ever thought that Slater or Murdoch were main event guys. How, Jeff? Jeff, is, let me ask you a question, Jeff. Is the earth flat?
You know, it must be.
Okay, it must be.
So because, let's see, Slater was a main eventer in CWF for how long? He was a main eventer in Mid-South as the North American champion. He was Georgia. The main eventer at Georgia. Oh, yeah, he had a big run in Georgia in the mid-70s. He Texas and Southwest. He was the Southwest champion. Had a run there for a long time in San Antonio. In Mid-Atlantic, he had, besides everything else, he had a major feud that set the stage for Starrcade with Ric Flair and Bob Orton, and all those guys were involved. So to say Dick Slater
Knoxville?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. And we should say, too, these main event runs in Georgia and Florida, there was more than one. There was multiple. Yeah. He main evented in Florida, what, three or four different runs?
And when
as both babyface and heel.
And we said and admitted that he did not get over in WWE. He was given a horrible gimmick, first of all, you use a gimmick like the Rebel. Chances are in the Northeast, at least, you're not going to have a real good chance of getting over, which is why they did not give Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong the Southern Boys gimmick and bring them to WWE, because chances are that would have fallen flat, too. But But Dick Slater was a huge, huge deal in the industry. Unfortunately, here again, you know,
Dick Slater was the Missouri fucking champion and won the title from Jack Briscoe. Sam Munchnick puts the Missouri title on Slater over Jack Briscoe, and he's not a main event guy. I mean, you got
to
be
according to Rod Stevenson.
You got to be kidding me. I just here's the one thing. If you want to look, the Hall of Fame, it's not subjective, or it is subjective. It's very subjective. Obviously, it shouldn't be, but it is. It's going to be your favorites. But if you're going to make a statement like this guy wasn't Hall of Fame material because he never main evented, and you're talking about guys like Slater, Wahoo, and Murdoch, you're 100% wrong. 100% wrong. And I've got the facts. It's not my opinion. I've got the facts to back that up.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, that we commented last week when we were talking about Rocky Johnson, we said, well, maybe people remember him as, oh, that's the guy that was Tony Atlas's tag team partner. Because, of course, we're talking about a newer generation, guys that are younger than us. And maybe they look at Dick Slater and they say, oh, that was the guy that was in the they used to call him the Hard Dicks in the Observer with his tag team with Murdoch in the was it the early part of the 90s? And, you know, both guys were obviously past their prime. They were collecting a paycheck. Good for them.
But they were still good, though.
But the point is, those guys that you saw in the early 90s, that was not the Dick Murdoch from the mid-70s. That was a guy that was considered at the time that Dory Funk Jr. was given the world championship. He was a guy that people were putting up to be the NWA world champion. Okay. Now, should he have actually gotten the title? Would he have been good? As far as work rate, he absolutely deserved it, because when Dick Murdoch was, when he was well and he was in the mood, he was as good as anybody in the business. Now, he also had nights where he goofed off, and it, you know, pretty much I think anybody that's a fan of Dick Murdoch will admit that. But Dick Murdoch also, Dick Murdoch never headlined anywhere. Let me get to that subject right now, Barry. Dick Murdoch, first of all, before I give it to Barry, Dick Murdoch was like the lead American in New Japan Wrestling, I want to say for like 2 years. So, you know, he was the guy that carried the ball for the American side when Inoki was still in charge, when they were doing all that stuff. And I had the chance in December of 1987 to go over there, and I saw him. He was the guy that carried he was Antonio Inoki's partner in the damn tag team tournament. If you don't think that Antonio Inoki is going to team up with somebody that's not a big deal in the tournament, you're dead wrong. So why don't you tell good old Ron and Chris, tell them a few places where Dick Murdoch may have main evented. I think maybe Florida.
Yeah, definitely Florida too. And he actually, Dick Murdoch was really instrumental in the formation of Barry Windham as we know Windham. And a lot of that was he came in late 1980 and was kind of teaming with Windham. And then he turned on him, and these two had a main event program. And then, of course, it was Dusty and Murdoch. But he had been around 10 years earlier as a main event heel. Murdoch had several runs in Florida where he was always the main event. Texas, he was the main event. What he did for Bill Watts, and let that be the barometer, because Bill Watts never put anybody on top in his territory if they didn't draw him money. And Dick Murdoch was in and out of Mid-South and the UWF for some 20 years. And even at the end of the UWF, Dick Murdoch was still working on top. But again, people are going to go off of this tag team with Adrian Adonis, which you and I have raved about. But there were some comedy skits. And then, as you mentioned, there were some nights that Dick Murdoch would goof off in the ring and have fun. And there was the alleged statements that have been made. And I forget who said it. It may have been Dusty Rhodes, or maybe not, that he was in some exclusive clubs that were exclusive to Caucasians, Jeff. And should that prevent him from being in a Hall of Fame, which doesn't technically even exist? There's no brick and mortar building. It lives in the air, lives in the cloud. No, it shouldn't. The guy was a fantastic worker. The other aspect, and this is really the part where Ron made one of the more ludicrous statements, and I've got to be able to pull it up and find it, was that he's never talked with anybody in the business or fans that thought that these guys were all that. And I'm paraphrasing. That isn't exactly the wording that he used. Well, that right there is the biggest load of bullshit, because the respect level that these two dicks had is immeasurable. Murdoch was another one that was Missouri heavyweight champion. And you just said it, when Murdoch was Missouri heavyweight champion, the big rumor going around was he was going to get the world title next, that he would be the guy to be the next world's heavyweight champion. So, you know, it's one thing if you don't like somebody, and I get it, because we all have favorites. Look, we all have favorites that we think are great, and then guys that we don't think are great. But if you're looking at somebody's career really, you know, objectively and fairly, how can you in God's name say that the two dicks can't be in the Hall of Fame? And the same when it comes to Wahoo. Where did Wahoo ever work that Wahoo was mid-card, other than the last 2 years of his career? You know, or something like that. You can't. Everywhere that Wahoo McDaniel went, you know, during the territories, and then even the beginning of the expansion, because then he was still a big deal in the Mid-Atlantic area, Wahoo was always on top. Why was he on top? Two reasons. He could work fucking circles around most people in the ring, and he drew money. End of story, Jeff.
Yeah, and he also was the guy, let's be really candid, and this person will admit it, that made Ric Flair in the Mid-Atlantic area. Because it was Wahoo McDaniel that, you know, looked at the promotion or promoters and said, give me the kid and I'll try to do something with him. He made Ric Flair in Mid-Atlantic. And so if nothing, you know, that's pretty much right there. You know, that's enough just to get you up to bat for the Hall of Fame consideration. But if you want to take it a step further, think of how many places that Wahoo, and, you know, we talked about the AWA in the mid-80s was not necessarily a national promotion. OK, it was more of a regional promotion. But you know, if you look at some of the cards that are posted out there on the internet, of AWA stuff in like, let's say the mid 70s, 73, 74, 75 ish. And Wahoo was working the top of the card when that may have been the best promotion in the world. I mean, they had unbelievable amount of talents on those shows, and Wahoo was working with superstar Billy Graham and those matches. Yeah. And they went back and forth before Superstar had his first run in the WWF. And Wahoo is definitely a guy that also belongs. All four of those guys, deserve the consideration and that, Rocky Johnson and Dick Murdoch and Dick Slater, certainly to say that they're unworthy even of consideration because they were never on top anywhere. So, it's just kind of ludicrous to me also. And let me say, let me just throw this out there. We talked about how Rick Martel has a reputation of being a really good guy. Okay. Here's a little factoid in case people don't know this. Not every guy in the wrestling business is Rick Martel or Tito Santana, two genuinely nice guys. There are guys out there that are incredibly talented, guys that are worthy of the Hall of Fame, who are complete fucking douchebags.
Yes.
That may come as a huge surprise to people. But you know what? It's like I think I talked about it last week, Ty Cobb, one of the greatest hitters of all time in Major League Baseball, is in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. Why? Because he was a great player. Nobody considered, is Ty Cobb a really good guy? No, he was a huge fucking douchebag by all accounts. But what we're considering is not whether Ty Cobb was a huge douchebag. It was Ty Cobb one of the two or three best hitters of all time in baseball? Fuck yeah. So when you stop and think about Dick Murdoch or Wahoo had some crazy off outside the ring stories that people told about him, bar fights and all this kind of stuff. So not everybody is Rick Martel or Tito Santana. There are some guys that are incredibly talented, Hall of Fame worthy wrestlers, guys that are already in. Okay. Let's be honest. Hey, how many people don't like Ric Flair? Ric Flair is arguably the greatest wrestler of all time in a lot of people's minds, but there are people that think Ric Flair is a huge douchebag. OK, a guy that let's just say in the era of Me Too and social media, if some of the stuff that Ric Flair was alleged to have done in the 70s and into the 80s would have gotten out there on social media, he would have been some sort of social pariah because of the stuff that he was alleged to have done. Let's kind of take everything with a little grain of salt here, folks.
Yeah, you're right, too. And Sean Goodwin, our good friend, Sean Goodwin from the Stick to Wrestling podcast with John McAdam, made a comment today in our group, too. And he said, if Dick Murdoch is the gatekeeper, maybe we should move the gate. The guy was a main eventer and draw wherever he went and had good matches with almost everyone. That right there sums it up. It's the truth. And that's what it is. Dick Murdoch had the trust and the faith of the promoters. This was a guy that you brought in because he knew how to get over, and they knew that he was going to be drawing money, and that's what it's all about. So honestly, I'll never understand the Murdoch thing. I get that outside of the ring he may not have been an angel. Again, I don't think that should matter. And if you're basing Murdoch off of the last few years of his life in his career, I get that, but do the research, do the history, and see what this guy's career was all about.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, Barry, it's time. Let's move forward on the remainder of our Hall of Fame ballots. Going to take a look at some candidates that are next up. The next group that we came in, do you got your Hall of Fame ballot there in front of you, Barry, so we can discuss this?
I'll pretend like I do, Jeff. Yes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Next, we're going to talk about Japan. Okay. Now, honestly, as I looked at this, the candidates that are up for consideration this year, before I start discussing them, we have Jun Akiyama, Sima, Satoshi Kojima and Hiroshi Tenzan, Yoshiaki Fujiwara, Hayabusa, Kota Ibushi, Tomohiro Ishii, Tatsuya Naito, Kenny Omega, Miyako Satomura, and Akira Taue. Now, I'm going to tell you that last year I voted for Akira Taue because he was one of the four pillars or whatever they called him in the All Japan, along with Kenta Kobashi and Toshiaki Kawada, and of course, the late Mitsuharu Misawa. And upon reflection and having a chance to think about it, I don't really know that Taue, even though he was a main eventer, I'm going to say he wasn't up to the standard of those other three guys. So I'm not going to vote for him this year. The other guy that I thought maybe could have gotten in that I may have voted for was Jun Akiyama, who was also a really big deal in the last years of Baba's promotion. He was one of the bigger stars in promotion. As I look at this list, though, there are four names on here. Tomohiro Ishii, Tetsuya Naito, Kenny Omega, and Kota Ibushi. These guys, they're still working and are still main eventing, and they've been around for long enough to be on the ballot. But some of these guys, like Omega, and I realize he's a really polarizing figure to some people in the 605 page. But guys like Ishii has been a great. They've been great wrestlers, but they've never really been given the ball and ran with it for an extended period of time, like say Tanahashi or somebody like that did. And so I think it's a little, even though they're eligible, I think it's premature to say those guys should be getting in. The other guy I want to point out, although he was never a headliner, Fujiwara, behind the scenes, the guys that he trained and the effect he and the impact he had with the UWF and some of those groups, he is probably the closest, I think, to being considered, just because of maybe not so much his main event status as a wrestler, but stuff that he did almost behind the scenes. Barry, did you see anybody there that you think is a shoe-in from Japan?
Well, you know, Tawei is interesting, and I'll tell you what, Tawei was a guy that definitely, out of the four pillars, he was the guy that got the least amount of respect, and he wasn't spectacular by any stretch, but he was always very solid. But if you go back and you watch the older matches with Tawei, there is a certain appreciation that you have for him now when you see his matches. Well, I'll tell you one thing I'm not a fan of, and I don't think that guys that are active should be eligible for a Hall of Fame, because if you're going off of somebody's career, you know, I think the full career, the full scope of the career needs to be taken into account if you're going to vote somebody in the Hall of Fame. So, you know, Kota Ibushi, at this level that he's at, how long has he been wrestling? I mean, how long has he been in the public eye? 5 years? I mean, he's been wrestling.
Well, I mean, he worked a lot of like smaller promotions in Japan, worked himself up right to where he's now. And now he's a big deal in New Japan. There's no doubt about it. He's been given the ball and he's running with it. And he's fantastic. He might be my favorite wrestler in the world right now. But how can you say he's a Hall of Famer at this point? I mean, it'd be like making somebody like, this is probably a bad comparison, but it'd be like saying Patrick Mahomes of the Chiefs is a Hall of Fame player based on, you know, what he's had at the top. You know, 1 year, and I realize Kota Ibushi's wrestled longer than that in smaller promotions, so that's probably not a good comparison. But even like Omega's run was like 3 years, and he was great on top in New Japan, and now he's basically disappeared for the last year while AEW is starting up, okay? Naito, we've talked about before, they had a chance to make that guy the face of the promotion, and I feel like they gave him the chance, and then they kind of pulled the rug out from under him.
Yeah.
Ishii, I think, is a fantastic, fantastic performer. He might be the wrestler of the year in New Japan, but he's never been a guy that they put in the main events and gave him the ball and told him to run with it. He's been a guy in the semi-main event, let's just say. And every time they put him there, he's been fantastic and done a great job. But has he been the guy, you know, to use Ron Stevenson? Has he carried the promotion? I don't think he's done that. I think in the ring, he's Hall of Fame caliber, but I don't know if you're going to use that sort of category. I don't know if Ishii really deserves Hall of Fame consideration yet. You know, again, if these guys, if they continue, absolutely, they're potential candidates, all four of them. Who knows? Maybe Omega makes AEW as the lead star in that promotion, unless Cody decides otherwise. Maybe he takes the ball and for 5 years is a headliner and he turns AEW into a legitimate contender to the WWE. I don't see that happening, but maybe he does. And then certainly he's certainly solidified and even raised the bar for his potential candidacy for the Hall of Fame. But right now, I just don't think so. Not yet.
Yeah, I mean, everything you just said, I basically agree with. Is you know,
say it, Barry. Say the words you always say about that.
Oh yeah, hold on, Jeff. Let me make myself. Jeff, you are 100% right, sir.
Thank you. We had to check that box there for the.
We did have to check that box, but again, you know, how old is Kota Ibushi? By the way, is he still in his 20s?
No, believe it or not, Kota Ibushi is like 36 or 37.
Get the fuck out of here.
No,
seriously?
I swear to God, I couldn't believe it, because I had checked it about a month or so back. I was checking, I was looking on stuff up about Kota Ibushi. I was like, holy shit, how old is this guy? He's got the Bieber fucking hairdo, and I thought he was like 25 years old.
That sucks in some ways, though, because he's basically peaking right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I thought he would have a much longer career. I thought I thought in 5 years, this guy's going to be the biggest deal ever. He's great. Again, when guys still have years in front of them, and really specifically Ibushi and Kenny Omega, they've got to be excluded from the Hall of Fame. I think Jun Akiyama is also a really good choice right there, because this was a guy that, you know, after, let's say, the glory days of All Japan, you know, after the Shiruta and the Baba and the Hansen and all that, this is where Jun kind of took over and became his stage. But he kind of carried that promotion there for several years. So that's somebody that I think should get serious consideration.
Yeah. Now, real briefly, I wanted to discuss that there are wrestlers from Mexico. I am not a big Lucha Libre guy. I know some of the names, but I'm not somebody that actively watches. Barry, are you an active viewer of Lucha Libre?
You know, I was. It's not something I think that I'm active at the moment, but you're going back a few years ago. Yeah, I definitely was.
Well, okay. So I reached out to Mr. Lucha, Roy Lucier, friend of the show, friend of the Facebook group. And I asked Roy, I said, okay, here are some candidates. Tell me who you think definitely deserves to be a member of this group if we were voting. And Roy's thoughts were, he thought Los Brazos, Caristico, Karloff Lagrad, Los Misioneros de la Muerte, which was El Signo, El Tijicano, and Negro Navarro, and Hurricane Ramirez were the guys that he felt out of the suggested list should have gotten in.
Yeah, I want to hear you pronounce those names again, Jeff.
Well, yeah, I lived in South Florida all those years, and I worked in Hialeah for years.
My day right there.
All I know are the malas palabras, okay? I know the bad words. I have to say those, and I picked all those up. Okay, now, so thank you, Roy, for that, by the way. So, Mr. Smartass, now let's talk about...
This is now my favorite episode, just based off of hearing you pronounce those, so that was good.
Yosayamo, Jacinto, yes.
Los Misioneros.
Hey, here's one for you, Barry. Chupa mi pinga. Okay, anyway. Which is the first time that's been said on Breaking Kayfabe here on the two-year anniversary.
Stellar. Absolutely.
Thank you. Now let's go to the folks that are candidates from Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific Islands, and Africa, which, of course, has a big wrestling contingent here. So, Barry, here's a name, Spiros Arion. Now, Spiros Arion was a big deal in Australia, but he, of course, had a major, major run in the WWF with Bruno. Huge feud after the turn on Bruno. Do you remember anything about Spiros Arion?
Yeah, so, I mean, Spiros Arion was a guy that had a babyface run in the 1960s in the WWF. 10 years later, came back and was turned heel, but was a gigantic star down in New Zealand and Australia, which I believe is where he was from. So, you know, it's hard for me to say. I've only seen him, at least what I saw, and that's through the magic of videotape and YouTube, his heel run in the WWF in the 1970s. However, being familiar with his career, he was probably the top star, the top babyface in Australia when Australia was a thriving territory many, many, many years ago. So, yeah, that's a fantastic name right there.
So here's another candidate that is a big discussion point last year at this time in the 605 Super Podcast, Big Daddy from England. I believe his name was Shirley Crabtree.
Yeah, so that'll be one that'll definitely be kind of polarizing for a couple of reasons. I think he was, based off of what I've seen and everything that I've read, he was terrible in the ring. He was gigantic. He was also the promoter and or owner of the promotion. So he was putting himself on top. But what I am able to gather based off of his career was he was a huge draw. And he's arguably, I think when you talk from, he was the Hulk Hogan of England. So, you know, it's hard to say who the best worker was of all time. Certainly, he'll never fall into that category. And there were a million amazing wrestlers coming out of England. But maybe from a popularity standpoint, he might have been the most popular of all time. Big Daddy Shirley Crabtree. Does that justify that he goes in the Hall of Fame? Maybe it does. Maybe he drew the most money. And that really should be the barometer, right, Jeff, on a lot of different ways?
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, I think with the Observer Hall of Fame, they're also, they have to be including the work, you know, the someone's ability to work in the ring. And certainly with Big Daddy, they're taking that away from him because as you compare him to Hulk Hogan, compared to Big Daddy, Hulk Hogan was like a house of fire in the ring.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and Big Daddy was just all kind of awful in the ring. Yep. But he was a guy that put asses in the seats back when that's what counted most. Okay, the next one, Dominic DiNucci.
So here's the funny thing about Dominic DiNucci. I was a fan of DiNucci when I was a kid, and he was actually one half of the Florida Tag Team Champions with Tony Parisi, 1974 and 1975. And I liked him. I've heard it said that he was not a good worker, and I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know. Did he have a Hall of Fame career in the United States? I don't think he did. He was WWF Tag Team Champion at least once, maybe a couple of times. Good friend of Bruno, obviously. But in the U.S., he didn't have this, you know, amazing career. Definitely huge in Pittsburgh. I can tell you I was in Pittsburgh this past weekend, and somebody actually, when I mentioned professional wrestling, they said, oh, do you remember Dominic DiNucci? So in Pittsburgh, he still kind of got that whole thing going. But I don't know in the U.S. if he worked enough territories to be a Hall of Fame career. In Australia, he was a big deal as well, though. And that's what you're talking about, because you mentioned that this was based off of out of the U.S. So I know he was a gigantic star in Australia in the 1960s. Is it Hall of Fame worthy? I don't know, but I don't know enough about it, I should say. But I want to say I believe Meltzer has written about it and basically said he was the top star in Australia for several years. So that it's a big deal then.
Well, I think obviously if you go based on what he did in the United States, as you said, his primary role was even less than what like the Jay Strongbow role was during the Backlund years. He was the guy that they would always attack Dominic, and that would be what set up the program with Bruno. He did have the run as tag team champion in Florida, a big deal down in Australia. You know, one of the guys that they've talked about on the 605 podcast is Mario Milano, because obviously there was a huge Italian population down in Australia. So that's one of the things they would bring in the Italian guys to appeal to their fan base. And I want to say, I don't know if Mario Milano wasn't a bigger deal as a babyface down there than Dominic DiNucci. What do you think?
Yeah, that's probably a good comparison too. Mario Milano was another one. I think he falls into that Spiros Arion category. Was a guy that was gigantic. Mario Milano actually had a decent career in the U.S. as well, though, working several southern territories where he was a big deal. But I think these are, from a babyface standpoint, I think DiNucci, Spiros Arion, and Mario Milano are the big three.
Yeah. So let's go on with I'm going to skip one here, Barry, because I think it's a really good talking point, much like the talking point we had at the beginning of this segment. So right. I'll throw you four names out that were very well-known in England, and that is Kendo Nagasaki, not to be confused with the Kendo Nagasaki that wrestled in Florida and here in the United States, but the British version of Kendo Nagasaki. Jackie Paolo, who I believe his nickname was Mr. TV, Rollerball, it's easy for me to say, Mark Rocco, and Johnny Saint. So what do you think out of those four? Anybody Hall of Fame caliber strike you based on what you've heard?
Well, Jackie Paolo, his nickname was Mr. TV, and he was, I guess, part of the whole era when they ushered in television wrestling over in England. So he might have been kind of the Gorgeous George. I don't know if that's a fair comparison, but possibly the Gorgeous George of England at that point. The last two names that you mentioned, Kendo Nagasaki was another guy, too, and I did see video of him. I wasn't impressed, but he had a hell of a career over in England, and maybe besides Big Daddy, maybe one of the more well-known professional wrestlers. But the last two names you mentioned, which were Johnny Saint and especially Mark Rocco, Rollerball, these two guys were fucking aces. And Johnny Saint still works with NXT UK. I believe he's the commissioner, if I'm correct. But Mark Rollerball Rocco was a guy that was in Japan, in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s. And there's a bunch of Jushin Liger versus Rocco matches. That guy was something else. And I don't know. Again, I think maybe we're looking, when we talk about a guy like Rocco versus Jackie Paolo, I think Rocco was the far superior worker, but maybe Paolo drew more money. So it's a real catch-22 there. You know, from my own standpoint, and you can't go off, I don't think I speak for the everyman in this situation, but I could watch Rocco matches all day long. I mean, you've seen it. He's phenomenal.
Oh, Mark Rocco was famous I want to say he was even more famous in Japan than he maybe was in England, because Mark Rocco was in Japan, was Black Tiger. And Black Tiger, the storyline, I believe, as I recall, when Satoru Sayama became Tiger Mask, was that much like, you know, going back to the old cartoon that now I'm drawing a Speed Racer. I was drawing a complete blank, Blake there. Well, Speed Racer, of course. His brother was Racer X, if you remember. And I think the storyline with Tiger Mask was that Black Tiger was like his brother who had kind of gone and become sort of a bad guy. And so Mark Rocco was one of – as famous as the matches between Sayama as Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid are, the storyline that was created for Mark Rocco was a longer lasting program, because the brother versus brother aspect, I think, really kind of appealed to people, and just a fantastic, fantastic worker. I don't know whether or not he's quite Hall of Fame, but he's one of those guys that I would think would be pretty close. Superior talent in the ring. There's no question about it. Okay, going back even further, Barry, I don't know. I've seen some video of this guy, Ricky Starr, who did kind of the ballet gimmick, believe it or not, but as a baby face, as I recall.
Yeah, too. It's Ricky, and that was a guy that was really interesting, because here was a guy, Ricky Starr, that was doing the ballet gimmick. And also, he had a brother that wrestled named Mark Starr, who actually spent several years working territories in and around, and actually was in Florida multiple times. Ricky Starr, and then I think he moved over to Europe and then disappeared and was off the radar for years, and nobody knew where he was. And I believe he has since passed on. But he was a guy that apparently, and I never saw him, I've never even seen footage of him, but he was one of these guys you would read about in the magazine. And, I think he was polarizing in that, you know, especially if you're looking at the 1950s and 60s, you had a guy that was wearing ballet slippers to the ring, but he was a babyface. And that didn't always jive with the people sitting in the audience in the crowd at the time. So I don't know. I don't know if he deserves to be in a Hall of Fame, but it's certainly a name that I think people familiar with wrestling from the 60s and 70s are very, very familiar with.
Yeah. Okay. Last guy to discuss, and a guy that I think we could, safely compare. We spoke earlier of Big Daddy, and that's Otto Wanz in Germany. Now, Otto Wanz was a big, huge, kind of a load, but
load.
Yeah, was a big deal, you know, for all the German tours and stuff like that, because he owned the promotion. Go figure, right? And so I wonder whether or not Otto Wanz, the consideration for Otto Wanz. Maybe not necessarily as a wrestler, as a promoter, I think he has probably a better case, because he promoted for, good Lord, I want to say like 20 years. He was the guy doing all the German tours where a lot of young Americans got their first start, and guys from Japan would go over and do the German tours. So he was a really big deal. And, you know, as Lou, thanks for the heads up, I was going to get there. He was also the AWA world champion in the early 80s, bought himself that title, as I famously heard, but he did have a run as the AWA world champion. So what do you think? Otto Wanz.
I've only seen Otto Wanz, I think, one or two matches. And if I'm going off of what I've seen, I don't see him in a Hall of Fame. But again, if this was the biggest star over in Germany, certainly he owned the promotion and pushed himself the hardest. Maybe he does. I don't know. I'm not overly familiar with the political machinations of German professional wrestling. I've just seen the guy, and I've
think you're more familiar with the German porn than you are the German wrestling. Am I correct?
We could talk all day, Jeff. We could talk about that if you want to. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm going to say no on Otto Wanz, but you know, certainly if somebody can make a case for him being in it, I might actually agree to that.
We'll wait for Ron Stevenson's opinion.
Otto Wanz. Exactly.
Okay, now let's get to the last segment, which I think is really interesting, because I think there's some real interesting candidates in the non-wrestler category. Starting off with Lord Jim. Now, he was a wrestler, but he's more famous as an announcer, as the guy that was the All Japan commissioner for, I think, like 940 years. Lord James Blears. Tally-ho!
Tally-ho. So again, another guy that I have never seen wrestle, you know, I don't even think I've even seen him on YouTube. But again, if you look at what his career was, he had a very solid career for many years. I would assume he drew money because he was always on top, and it had to be the gimmick. The gimmick had to get him on top. I would be okay with him being in the Hall of Fame.
Okay, next, Dave Brown.
Dave Brown from Memphis. TV? As a commentator?
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to talk bad about Dave. What separates Dave Brown? What other commentators are in the Hall of Fame? That's what it would come to. I mean, are we putting him ahead of really great commentators? You know, because Dave Brown to me was good, but I don't see this is going to kill people in Memphis right now, Jeff. Dave Brown was good, but I don't see anything that would separate Dave Brown from any other commentator. He wasn't bad. He certainly was no Ed Whalen, who was a fucking, you know, he was horrific. I just don't see where Dave Brown is.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll throw out a name, and you tell me whether or not you liked. Lou said Scott Bowden hopping on a plane right now to come kick a little ass. So he's probably right about that. Yeah. Do you like Dave Brown more than you liked Boyd Pierce? And Boyd Pierce is not a candidate. I don't know if he's already in or not. He's not on this list of candidates. Yeah. So just I'm going to throw a name out to you. Did you like Boyd Pierce better than Dave Brown?
I've got to assume that Boyd Pierce is not in the Hall of Fame. I don't. I could see the difference. Let me put it this way. I might have liked Boyd Pierce better. But I could also see where Dave Brown had a more professional overall appearance, not just his physical appearance, but I mean, even his delivery. And Dave Brown was good. Look, it's not, you know, but I. All right. I got to. So one of the things as we record this and this is part of our discussion, Chris, and I love you, Chris. So first off, if I didn't love you, I would absolutely probably be going fucking ape shit out of my mind at this moment. But Christian Ault chiming in on Sean Goodwin's comment, Murdoch is not a Hall of Famer. So, hold on, Jeff, as I clutch my heart. He took way too many nights off. If this was real sports, you guys would be burying him for not reaching his potential.
I'm sorry. Are we doing a pro wrestling podcast? Or are we doing it?
He was at the top of the card, but never the focus of the promotion. So let me go back. I'm going to go line by line with this, Jeff, and I want to get your reaction. First off, Murdoch is not a Hall of Famer. I think we both can disagree, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And he just made another comment. Okay. And that one's not important. So we can go with that one. Dun, dun. Hold on. And this is a slight tag. Okay. He took way too many nights off. Now, we both acknowledged he did take nights off.
Yes.
However, a lot of guys took nights off back in those days. That this is not an exception to the rule. There were a few guys. I think Ric Flair is one of these guys that we can say he really didn't take nights off. Ric Flair, God bless him, would go out there and granted, some nights it was the same match over and over, but he went out and delivered. Yes, Murdoch did take nights off some nights. So we'll agree with that. If this was real sports, you guys would be burying him for not reaching his potential. Jeff, feel free.
Well, first of all, there are guys, I hate to, you know, burst anyone's bubble here, but there are guys in the NFL, there are guys in the Major League Baseball, in the NBA, oh boy, in the NBA, and in the NHL. They go out there sometimes and they give it a half-assed, let's get through the night kind of effort, you know? And then there are guys that are completely committed and want to go out there and probably should be committed because they're giving the proverbial 150% every single night of their life. And some guys that when you combine a truly great player with a guy that has that built in, I'm going to give my 100% or 150 every night. That's when you get a guy like a Michael Jordan. And then you get guys that maybe don't reach their potential because they're half-assing it. But if you have enough potential, or I'm sorry, if you have enough ability and you occasionally half-ass it, then you're good enough to still be in the Hall of Fame. I hate to draw this comparison because, you know, I'm not necessarily going to make him this far elite, but, you know, Randy Moss is probably, I think, one of the I won't say they're one of the top five receivers in the history of the NFL. Okay. And there are people that have said if Randy Moss would have given in every bit of his effort, every single game that he played in the NFL, he would be even greater than Jerry Rice. And the reason he wasn't is because Jerry Rice gave that effort on every single game. But Randy Moss had enough ability when he played for the Vikings, not so much with the Raiders, but when he played with the Patriots and Tom Brady, where he did give that effort. And that's why he's in the Hall of Fame. And that's why Dick Murdoch, because he had that ability. And on the nights when he gave that effort, you forgot about the nights that he took the night off. And he showed you that he was a Hall of Famer. So, yes, I would say Dick. Yeah.
Yeah. But so this is the line that I think gets me. Again, Murdoch is not a Hall of Famer. That's an opinion. That's absolutely fine.
And he's being very dismissive of him, too. That's what it's not like he's saying, well, he says, oh, he took nights off. Okay. Well, how about you give us some more research there, Mr. Wikipedia? Why don't you tell us what you know, not what you've read? Tell us about the matches on YouTube that you've watched where you feel after watching 100 of Dick Murdoch's matches, which I can conservatively say that Barry and I have seen at least 100 Murdoch matches, where you sit there and say, oh, based on what I've seen in these 100 matches, this guy's, Kevin Nash. He's the shits, and he doesn't deserve to be anywhere near the Hall of Fame. But you're just being dismissive, and whether it's based on stuff you've read or maybe you have watched those 100 matches. And if you have, God bless you, and you've now formulated an opinion. But I happen to think it's an incorrect one. But it's just that, an opinion.
Well, okay, so again, Murdoch is not a Hall of Famer, is an opinion. More power to you, because if you don't think that's up to you. You don't have to think that. He took way too many nights off. We actually agreed. He did take a lot of nights off. If this was real sports, and at that point we can just stop, because this is not. This is fucking professional wrestling. It's a worked entertainment. But it's this last line that I take issue with, Jeff, because it is factually incorrect. And that's where I have the issue. He was at the top of the card, but never the focus of the promotion. Chris, I love you. I call fucking bullshit. My friend, I can tell you as a 16 and 17-year-old sitting in the seats in the early 80s, he was the focus of the promotion in the state of Florida as a heel. In Texas, in West Texas, for years, he was the focus of the promotion. In Mid-South for Bill Watts, multiple runs. He was at the top of the card, and he was the focus of the promotion. He was a Hall of Famer based off of that. That is not my opinion. That is a fact. He was the focus of the promotion many times.
All right. We got to start.
I know we do. We got 6 hours.
We can spend 6 hours. Talking about Christian Alt here. Okay. I'm going to throw three names that are kind of, I'm going to keep them together because they all work for the same promotion.
Okay.
Bob Caudle, Jim Crockett Jr. and Jim Crockett Sr. Hall of Fame. Yes or no?
I mean, I'm going to say no to all. I mean, Jim Crockett Jr. Really? I mean, come on, really?
I know, I bankrupted my dad's company, but David I still have Crockett? An idea.
David Crockett? Like,
no.
You got
no Jim Crockett Senior and Junior and Bob Caudle.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about as promoters, the Crocketts as promoters?
Well, I guess you're talking about them as promoters and Bob Caudle as an announcer.
Bob Caudle, I would put Bob Caudle, and people love Bob Caudle. It's the, he's got the he's almost in that Lance Russell, you can do no wrong kind of deal. And maybe rightly so. Bob Caudle is a wonderful human being and was very good at what he did. Again, I would have to see the names that he's ahead of before I'm putting him in a Hall of Fame, because I think he was limited in what he did. I think Jim Crockett Sr. as a promoter, more than anybody out of the three names that you mentioned, that would be the one name that I would probably look at the deepest and the most. Junior to some degree. Junior just, I think by the end, obviously, just made so many, serious errors and critical errors that he basically just destroyed and ruined his promotion.
Let's see. Gato from New Japan. Now, before you say anything, I will say as a tag team with, I think, Jado, I would not have him as a Hall of Fame based on what he's done over the last, 3 or 4 years as a booker. If that run continues, I think he absolutely should be in because he's been absolutely fantastic. with the exception, and I mentioned it here a couple of times, of the way they handled the Naito thing. And I don't know whether or not that's him doing that or some other, you know, big wig in the promotion. But Gato's booking is what made Okada a star in New Japan, in my opinion.
And I 100% agree.
I think you got to give him that. So, but I think, again, it's a little early. So here's a name that you want to compare to Bob Caudle. Bob Caudle or Larry Matizek?
Oh, equal. I you know what? That's apples oranges right there, Jeff. Depends what you're in the mood for. They're two guys. They're kind of similar to me. Bob Caudle, Larry Matizek was a wonderful human being, by the way. Really just one of, just aces.
Both of them, two great guys, no question.
Yeah, they really are. Bob Caudle had this very genteel, grandfatherly way about him that when I listened to him, I felt it's almost like you could tuck me into bed and have Bob Caudle like read me a bedtime story. Like I just felt secure when Bob Caudle's voice was out there. I guess Bob Caudle over Larry Matizek, but I mean, again, apples, oranges on that one.
Well, Larry Matizek to me, you know, I had a chance to buy some of the St. Louis wrestling DVDs at the wrestling reunion. And, you know, I loved watching, but St. Louis was a very, I'm going to use the word dry promotion. And what I mean by that is it was a promotion that was, I think they were famous for doing maybe one or two angles a year, it seemed like. And I think Sam Muchnick deliberately wanted Larry Matizek to approach it almost like a sportscaster. And, you know, what he was calling was a complete shoot, and that's fine. So I always thought Larry Matizek came off a little bit of dry as far as his personality and calling the action. But that might have been exactly what Sam Muchnick wanted him to do. So maybe he was following what the promoter and the owner or the company wanted them to do. So, you know, you have to give them that. Of the two, I think I would say Bob Caudle would be more of a Hall of Fame worthy than Larry Matizek. It's no offense to Larry Matizek, who we recently lost. Okay, next. Now, here's one that I'm waiting with bated breath for you to give a quick opinion on. Barry, Hall of Fame, Stephanie McMahon.
I mean, is that legit? Or is that just...
She is a candidate on the Observer.
I'll give a quick, instead of going into a 45-minute rant as I would with Murdoch or something like that, I'll just quickly say, no, absolutely not. Not at this stage. Anything could happen going forward, Jeff. But right now, absolutely not.
I would agree with you on that assessment. James Melby, a guy that was he was part of the Wrestling Review or the Ring magazine, one of those two that were not the Apter or the Stanley Weston magazines. That's how I know the name James Melby.
Yeah, James Melby, absolutely. So James Melby was a longtime fan and a wrestling, as much as I don't like the term wrestling historian, he was. And he was a guy that, with limited resources for getting information, was putting out these ring record books. And I think they were called Wrestling Facts in the 1970s, maybe even the 60s. I don't know. And this would have required massive amounts of research by going to a library and going through microfilm. So you're looking at hours upon hours to get all this information. So James Melby, as a guy that helped preserve wrestling history, and a guy that, if was alive today, would tell you that Dick Murdoch should be in the Hall of Fame. I absolutely vote yes on James Melby.
Okay, that's good. I like that one. Okay, now here's a guy that I believe is in his last year on the ballot, amazingly, that I really don't understand why this guy is not in yet. So I'm going to, before I even tell you the guy's name, I'm going to say he absolutely belongs in the Hall of Fame, and that is Don Owen. Don Owen was the face of Portland wrestling for, good Lord, Barry, what, 40 years? How is it, you know, how many guys' careers did he kickstart or give their first big breakthrough that ended up becoming huge deals in the wrestling business? Don Owen, yes or no in your opinion? Because it's a big yes for me.
Yeah, it's a big yes for me as well. And I'm going to say the reason this is probably a question was you're talking about a small market. So you're talking about Portland. It, you know, wasn't a big wrestling territory. It was a small territory. That being said, which I haven't said since last week, first time this episode was.
But I digress.
Yeah, but I digress. You won't find a lot of people with a negative word to say about Don Owen. They say most people would say he's a decent guy. He was also a good payoff guy. And he also knew how to promote professional wrestling, that he was drawing good crowds continually. He didn't have a lot of these roller coasters of, you know, 5,000, 1,000, something like that. It was pretty lateral all the way through. And that's really the sign of a good promoter, I think, that he was delivering the goods on a weekly basis. So I would say yes to Don Owen, absolutely.
Okay, speaking of promoters, Morris Siegel in Houston. Now, this was way before both our times, but Morris Siegel was the guy that brought Paul Bosch into Houston wrestling and was the promoter in Houston for, from the, I want to say the mid-30s or late-30s to the mid to late-50s when Paul Bosch took over the promotion.
Yeah, I would say yes to Morris Siegel as well. It's another guy that, he just did it. He did it all in Houston and was the mentor for Paul Bosch, as you mentioned. And he was the guy he brought in when I interviewed Paul Jones years ago, which we talked about actually a couple of years ago. Paul Jones passed away, I think, within the first few months of us doing the podcast. And we discussed him over a couple of episodes. But Paul Jones was glowing about Morris Siegel, just called him, a guy who understood how to promote. He was, I think there was a comparison to Sam Munchnik in a lot of ways. And obviously, Sam Munchnik should be in any professional wrestling Hall of Fame.
Okay, so here's a guy I think is going to have some differing opinions, because there are some people that think this guy was like a booking genius. There are others that think he was vastly overrated as a booker, George Scott. And fairly, we also have to include the fact that he was part of a very famous babyface tag team with his brother Sandy Scott as the great George Scott. So, I guess we can include him as a wrestler and as a booker.
Yeah, so as a wrestler, I don't know. I mean, I know he was the great Scott going back to, I think, the 40s, definitely the 50s. Had a huge run as the great Scott, was also part of a tag team, as you mentioned, with his brother Sandy. As a booker, he should go in. I know that it didn't end the way that type of career should end, and there was a lot of issues, but wasn't he the guy kind of responsible for WrestleMania 2? I mean, I know where Vince gets a lot of the credit. Wasn't George Scott the guy? Wasn't George Scott the guy that kind of revitalized the Mid-Atlantic area when?
Well, now there's where I want to take issue, because sure, he absolutely does get the credit for being the guy that put the whole Mulligan and Flair, that whole angle together.
But wasn't the difference that George Scott took the territory from guys like Johnny Weaver and George Becker on top for like 80 years or whatever that crazy number was, and then all of a sudden brought in like Johnny Valentine and Blackjack Mulligan? So he took a territory that was old and dying and revitalized it and made it arguably, and some people would say it's not even an argument, because I know you and I have had this discussion, that was the best territory of the 1970s in a lot of people's opinions.
Yeah, but you know, the issue that I have is that I have heard that George Scott received a lot of credit for the Mulligan Flair stuff that was going on towards the later part of the 70s, when in fact a lot of people think that these were angles and ideas for the program that Mulligan and Flair themselves would come up with on car rides between the towns and present them to Scott, and Scott essentially, you know, ran with the angles, but they were other people's ideas that George Scott got credit for. Now let's also include the fact that George Scott also came in and did a horrific job promoting or being the booker for WCW in the early part of 89, where he was fired right after the Clash of Champions in New Orleans, if I'm not mistaken, because things were just not going well. He had signed guys to contracts that were well past their prime. As a matter of fact, he was so bad that there were people that suspected that George Scott may have still been on Vince's payroll and was deliberately sabotaging WCW. Of course, Vince would never do something like that, I'm sure. But so, you know, he had a great run. You're absolutely right, around 74-5-ish, and was doing a fantastic job. Then towards the end of the run, maybe was getting credit for stuff that weren't necessarily all his ideas. Then he went up and did, in fact, work for Vince. Was very instrumental with Vince for up until about 85-ish. So you might be right. Maybe he should get credit for some of the WrestleManias. But then had an absolutely horrendous ending to his career as a booker. And I wonder whether or not that shouldn't also be taken into context.
I just don't know if that's enough to actually prevent him. And again, what he did in the Mid-Atlantic area, a lot of people talk about it, and it's again, he took a territory that had the same guys on top for years, and he completely brought in this brand new crew, and the people went nuts, and the houses went up, and and Sweet Lou checking in also booked short runs in Georgia, McGurk's territory, and World Class. McGurk's territory, if I'm correct, was considered a complete failure. And I believe that was around 81 or 82. And he brought in Paul Jones, brought in Jimmy Snuka, and brought in some guys. And it didn't really work. These guys didn't get over in that territory. World Class, I think, was okay. Georgia, I don't remember or knew that he booked Georgia.
Well, but... World Class, I think he was booking there in 86. And that's when they brought in Ron Pope.
So, well, there you go.
Yeah. So maybe that wasn't such a great run either.
So why don't we do this? Why don't we look at... Does George Scott, well, he does, though. Does he deserve, based off of completely a 180 in the Mid-Atlantic area, and then considering that he was the guy who was working hand-in-hand with Vince in the early days of the expansion, and obviously that was wildly successful?
I think you could definitely make an argument for him at the very least. You know, again, the stuff that was positive – definitely gets a huge thumbs up, but I think you got to factor in some of the negative stuff, the World Class stuff, time had passed by. But, you know, being completely candid, you know, if you think about Ole Anderson as a booker, Ole Anderson, you know, there were times when Ole Anderson was a genius as a booker. But yes. Then, of course, when Ole Anderson came back in 91 and time had passed him by and he did what so many bookers did, they would call guys that they knew, even though they were past their prime, because they want someone they can trust. And that's what George Scott was doing. He was calling guys in that he knew and he trusted. Famously, they brought in the Iron Sheik, who was, you know, really out of shape and was not anywhere near what he had been towards the beginning of his, you know, WWF run. But he was a guy that was a huge name that people would recognize. But he vastly overpaid him. And then, of course, famously, I think he signed him into one of those contracts that rolled over. And then, this isn't on George Scott. But then, of course, they forgot to send the notice of termination. So they ended up rolling over the Iron Sheik's contract for a second year because they didn't send him the paperwork to terminate him. I think George Scott's a really interesting kind of a 50-50 proposition for me. So I'll have to think about that one. Okay, here's another one. Ted Turner, a guy that wildly influenced the wrestling business in the 70s and 80s, Barry.
Yeah, he definitely did. I don't know. I don't know if he the only thing I would say with Ted Turner was – how hands-on was Ted Turner? He wasn't. He owned it, but he wasn't like day-to-day operations and hands-on. So I think it was a business venture for him. And if I'm correct, wasn't the reason that he wanted to have wrestling on TBS, right? He liked having wrestling on TBS. I don't think, he was running the company, but was he running the company? I don't know. I don't see Turner for some reason.
Okay. Stanley Weston.
Stanley Weston. Yeah, I guess so. You know, you got to look at it and go, okay, who's not in that maybe should be in. But Stanley Weston was a guy, and granted, he didn't put out, and Stanley Weston was, he was the After Magazines. He was the guy who was putting them out, and they became known as the After Magazines, but they were actually the Stanley Weston Magazines. He's been dead for, many years at this point. I think he died in the early 80s. I'm not 100% sure, but he made the professional wrestling magazines popular. Now, they weren't the best wrestling magazine. Certainly Wrestling Review was probably the best, but these were the most popular. And whether it was putting out apartment wrestling or the crazy after headlines, and all that stuff, these were the ones that really hit the mainstream that you saw on every newsstand. So in some ways, yeah, I'd say Stanley Weston does deserve.
Well, certainly the ones with the photos and the covers that everyone remembered. I don't think there's any question about that. So here's one that I think is an interesting one. Ernie Roth, the Grand Wizard.
I would say yes, only because he did a lot more than the Grand Wizard. He was Abdullah Farouk. He was Mr. Clean, I believe, at one point. So he had a career prior to that. The whole thing with, you know, the three wise men of the WWWF, which was Blassie Albano and the Grand Wizard, was these guys were never working house shows. They would just work television. That to me doesn't signify a Hall of Fame career. And I didn't think they were spectacular in what they were doing. But I think his other body of work, possibly, I don't know. It's a good one, though.
Yeah, no, I actually like him as a candidate because yeah. You're absolutely right. His work with the Sheik in Detroit as Abdullah Farouk, and I think he had a very influential run in the WWE. And again, a guy that behind the scenes was really doing a lot more behind the scenes than the average fan would realize and taking part. So now, before we got to start wrapping things up here, Barry, believe it or not, we have one guy that I skipped over. And, you know, we talked about Dick Murdoch and Dick Slater and guys like that who were controversial picks, mainly because of, you know, one of the things you mentioned was maybe they were outside the ring activities. Sure. And, you know, so a guy that's also faced that stigma that's on the ballot that I did not talk about because I wanted to save it to the end. Barry, a guy that was hugely famous in Florida, a guy that was famous because his angle was one of the angles that really brought me back to Florida in the early part of 1982, Barry Killer Carl Cox, Hall of Fame, yes or no?
All right. So here, this is an interesting one, and this is where you have to be objective. And I love Cox, Jeff. I've talked about it numerous times. He is one of my favorite.
Barbeau Rose also loves Cox.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't know if his career in the U.S. constitutes Hall of Fame.
Well,
I don't know.
So here's the thing. He's a candidate from Australia with the Australian thing. That's where. So if we're going to include that, where he was a huge deal in Australia, too. Factoring in the Australia and the U.S., do you think he deserves to get in?
I think he was a bigger deal in Australia. So looking at the U.S., he was a big deal for Watts in Mid-South. He had a massive feud with Dick Murdoch, who deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Have you mentioned that?
I was going to say, if I haven't mentioned that lately, they had a massive feud that they were also the best of friends. That went on for several years. And he was a star in Texas, huge star in Florida, star in Knoxville. And then, you know, worked regional territories, never a major star up north or in the AWA or anything like that. Really big star in Australia. One of the most hated.
Wasn't he a big deal in Detroit, or am I completely?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, actually, so. But I don't know how long of a big deal. I know it was a run, but I don't think it was a lengthy run. And this is what I read when he died. I remember reading his obituary, and he was based out of West Texas, but they would never put him on top. And I guess the reasoning being was that he spent so much time in either Japan or Australia that when he wasn't in Japan or Australia, he would come back and he would work in West Texas, but they would never put him on top because they knew that he was going to be gone shortly. He had amazing runs in Florida. And here was a guy, to his credit, that looked like your grandfather, you know, average height, maybe 5'10", 5'11", bit of a beer gut, balding, obviously a real tough son of a bitch, an ex-Marine, but at the same time, it just didn't look threatening, but yet was threatening, you know, got in the ring and had the respect. He got over huge in the state of Florida for a couple of years as both a heel and a babyface. You went heel, babyface, and back to heel. If you're looking at Australia, I know he was, you know, he's like a legend in Australia. I would say, yeah, in Australia. I'm just not quite sure about the U.S.
I am going to say damn the torpedoes and put Killer Carl Cox in for his body of work. Because, again, going on the Ernie Roth model, you have to also look at how many guys he influenced. Think of the influence he had on Dick Murdoch. Dick Murdoch, a lot of his characterizations and his mannerisms in the ring were stolen from Killer Carl Cox and other guys. I really think to some extent, I think Terry Funk was influenced by some of the stuff he saw Cox doing, you know, and there's no shame in taking a guy's great stuff and borrowing from it and molding it into your own little way, because that's what the wrestling business is all about. You know, there's no higher honor than to kind of steal someone's part of their gimmick and make it your own and then refine it and turn it into your own gimmick. And I think in some ways, I'm not saying Terry Funk did that, but he borrowed stuff from Cox because Cox was great at what he did. So I guess, Barry, for the first time, I'm going to say that I love Cox. Killer.
Wow. Cool. I feel a little envious with you actually saying that right now, too.
Yeah, it was the photo. That's what it was, Barry.
Yeah, there was this triad, too, Jeff. And just to, because we're, you know, obviously this has been a Dick Murdoch episode. And now we're bringing in Killer Carl Cox. But there was this triad in Mid-South and West Texas. And it essentially was Killer Carl Cox, Dick Murdoch, and Ted DiBiase. And you could put any one of these three together and you were getting some sort of magic being created. So and you can see a lot of Dick Murdoch and Cox or a lot of Cox and Murdoch.
Oy, I don't know if Cox was ever in Murdoch. I don't know if you want to put it that way.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So anyway, so that's my ballot. That's Barry's ballot. We'll put up our thoughts and our views, and I'm sure it's going to make for some lively discussion on the old Facebook page. Once again, folks, I would encourage you to go to our YouTube channel and subscribe if you haven't done so yet. And I find out about it, I'm going to call your ass out. That's all I'm going to say. So Barry, about ready to take it for the go home, my man.
Yeah, we want to say thank you to everybody that has supported us over the last 2 years. It has been, you know, it's
even
real funny.
Christian Ault and Ron Stevenson. Thank you for supporting it.
And the truth is, we actually love Christian Ault. Ron Stevenson, I'm not so crazy about. And Chris, just, you know, we have a big difference of opinion here. Ron made some really horrific incorrect statements that I think we definitely had to clarify and we had to get into. But it has been 2 years. It has been a lot of fun. We will continue to grow. There are no plans to change what we do. We just want to continue, as Jeff has mentioned numerous times, by supporting our YouTube channel, you support the show, which makes sure that we can continue to get interviews. And Jeff, I don't want to announce, but it looks like we may have a really good interview coming up next week.
That's what they call in the business a tease. I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special thanks and shout out, not to Brian Last, but to our man, Sweet Lou Kippelman. Thank you, Sweet Lou, for all your hard work. 2 years in the books, Barry. Let's make it another 2 years. What do you say, my man?
I think we could do it. Lou, are you with us, Lou? Can we do 2 more years?
Well, yeah,
that's
why the hell not?
Right there. Well, all right, we'll see you next week, folks. Thank you.